So, hey, everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on with Voices from the Frontlines, your 4 o'clock drive time, walk time, bicycle time, public affairs hour on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm going to be joined by Zachary Norris, who's the co-director of Justice for Families, to discuss his new report, Families Unlocking Futures, Solutions to the Crisis in Juvenile Justice. I'm also joined with Barbara Lott Holland, an organizer with the Community Rights Campaign of the Labor Community Strategy Center, who did some work on this report and did a lot of interviews with actual family members. Yesterday, Justice for Families released a report called Families Unlocking Futures, Solutions to the Crisis in Juvenile Justice, based on 1,000 in-depth interviews with parents and family members of incarcerated youth. It deals how the juvenile justice system does more than feed the nation's vast prison system than to deter or redirect young people from involvement in the system. It demonstrates the incredible damage the system causes to families and communities. So joining me to discuss the report is one of its authors, its primary author, Zachary Norris, co-director of Justice for Families, based in Oakland, California. Zach is an attorney, a Soros Justice Fellow, and was director of Books Not Bars, a campaign of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. And then Barbara Lott Holland is an organizer with the Los Angeles Bus Riders Union and the Community Rights Campaign, both of the Labor Community Strategy Center. Barbara directed the Los Angeles research work that the Community Rights Campaign helped to do for the report. So she and organizers all over the country conducted 100 of the report surveys, rather, just in LA. So welcome, Zach, and welcome, Barbara.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Barbara.
Well, Zach, very impressive report. Obviously, we'll get later is will this be heard? But there are so many elements of the report. I'm going to go into in a little bit. Why don't you tell me what the thinking was behind it? What made you want to do this?
The coalition of groups that put this together. There isn't one single author. We came together, Barbara and other family leaders from around the country, to really discuss the report findings and develop an outline for the report. So this is the work of hundreds of families across the country, and the goal was really to set the record straight in terms of demonstrating that the stereotypes, misperceptions that families of incarcerated and court-involved youth face are just wrong, and the ways in which families are treated actually undermines public safety in ways that aren't helpful. And so when we know that youth of color and poor youth are much more likely to be involved in the system, and their families are often demonized and excluded from decision-making points within the juvenile justice system in ways that don't help them, don't help public safety, and definitely don't help young people.
So one thing is, let's start with Zach, that there are so many different elements of the impact on the family. Why don't we start with the financial impact?
Sure. Yeah, we found that 1 out of 3 families have had to make a choice between paying for basic necessities like food. 1 out of 5 families have had to take out a loan to make court-related or other juvenile justice system-related costs. Families are mortgaging their homes. They are spending hundreds of dollars to visit their kids and their loved ones in faraway youth prisons. None of this helps anyone be safer, and in fact, it adds salt to the wounds of folks who are really struggling in tough economic times as it is.
Well, you've gone through that. Barbara, let's talk about the psychological effect. When you talked in the interviews, what were some of the psychological effects and emotional health impacts on families?
Some of them were still, even years after the effects, were still feeling it. Some, as we were even talking, first we did 2 focus groups, then we did the 100 surveys, and I observed family members' eyes watering up as they talked about the experience that they had, and even after having gone through it, and some of them more than once, was still in a daze and confused as the whole process. A lot of them still don't know exactly what happened and still seeking answers to what happened.
Well, one of the things in the report, I'm going to go over some things about stop locking, some of your recommendations. Just here's some really good quotes here about the financial. You can lose everything. Financially will pull you down trying to hold on to a child. Let's talk about, before I just get to, I want to read some of the recommendations, because by the recommendations, Zach, you have the thing about stop locking out families in the report. Why don't you read the recommendations, and then we'll go back and talk about it. But just the recommendations show how bad things are by what you're recommending.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty terrible. And amazing that, in a bad way, that we even have to make these recommendations. But, you know, some of the things that we call for is like the automatic notification of families in the event of suicide attempts or serious injury to young people, because we found that that's not happening. That young people, that their families are being notified days and sometimes even weeks after serious injury. And so these are things that it's not universally true across the country, but are certainly issues in a number of different cities and with a number of families that we talk to. And so those are the kinds of things that that we have to push for. 90% of families want to have a say when a young person is found delinquent or guilty in terms of what happens to that child, but less than 1 in 5 families were ever asked in a courtroom what they thought should happen. And so we call for, you know, allowing families to speak in courtrooms as a recommendation. And so this sort of baseline level of the exclusion of families is the first thing that we want to take up within a larger blueprint for youth justice transformation, to say that we need to stop the lockout of families. That these young people, if youth are going to succeed long term, that the folks who have the best chance of helping them succeed, their families and supportive community members, should not be excluded. That they should be brought into the process. And so that's one of the basic recommendations that we have.
Yes, the converse is really amazing, because it's sort of like, say, here's one: give families more timely notification of court dates, which means that families are not even getting notification of court dates. Hold court appearances when it's easier for families to attend hearings, which means they're not holding hearings when the family can show up. Support the family's transportation to court and residential placements. Why don't you talk about, Barbara, discontinuing taking away visits for misconduct in the facility?
That is one of the things that parents talked about. The financial stress of actually, some of these camps are far away, so they have to pay someone to take them. They know the visitation day. You take off from work, and which is a whole day's trip to go to a long distance, because your child is never close at home so that you can visit them. You stand in this, you go through this long process just to get into the system with the body checks and all of that. You wait in a room, and then someone comes and tells you that you're not going to be able to see your child today because something happens. Either they were disobedient, there was a fight in their dorm, and so the whole dorm now is on lockdown. So now they say they're sitting there just devastated. Just, okay, so what do I do? So now they have to wait until that transportation comes back to pick them up to go back home to try and find out what happened to their kid. Because they'll ask and they say, well, you have to talk to the social worker, or there's nobody here today that can answer that. We don't have any answers. This is just for visitation. So that is very devastating and draining to the parents and family.
Well, it's pretty amazing, as you said, just continue taking away visits for misconduct. I think you explained it well. And maintained a staffed hotline or a call center for families who have questions about visitation, 92% said that. How's this for something, Zach? Notify families of expected release dates to allow them sufficient time to prepare. Why don't you explain why we need that to be a recommendation?
I mean, it's just crazy, but, you know, I have gone with families when they were supposed to be able to expect their child to come home. One time I went with a family member who, she was expecting her son to be released before the Thanksgiving holiday. She drove literally hours to meet her son and was told that he was going to be held over until after the Thanksgiving holiday. So here she was preparing for her son to finally come home, only to be told as she got there that he wouldn't be home for the holiday, and he had been in for some time prior to that. So, you know, these kinds of basic rights have to be fought for, because the assumption is that families don't care, that they don't care about their loved ones, that they don't care about public safety. But as Barbara talked about, folks are traveling hours, they're taking out loans on their home, they're desperately trying to help young people succeed. And it's really, as that quote you mentioned talked about, pulling down the whole family. And so when young people get in trouble with the law, we're not just punishing them and excluding them in ways that hurt them long term. We're hurting families, and it doesn't make any sense because it doesn't improve community safety. We found that half of the families that we surveyed actually do have a survivor of crime in their families, but those families were actually more likely to support alternatives to detention and incarceration than other families, which to us demonstrates that, yes, families understand violence in communities is a problem, but also that the violence on communities that has been wrought by decades of failed criminal injustice policies is a huge problem and isn't advancing the needle in terms of making communities safer. So we really put forth recommendations that start with increasing families' power within justice systems and agency and ability to speak up for youth about what they need, but really is a part of a larger transformative agenda that we think is in the interest of many people to take up, because we are spending billions on incarceration at the expense of low-income communities of color predominantly, and this should be, you know, in the forefront in terms of racial and economic justice struggles, because this is very much about racial and economic justice.
We're reading a report called Families Unlocking Futures, Solutions to the Crisis in Juvenile Justice. We're with Zach Norris, who's one of the authors of it, and Barbara Lott Hollins, who's done over 100 interviews and focus groups for this. One thing I'm concerned about, if I can say, though, about where the debate is going, is I'm concerned that we keep having to say that this isn't the best way to create safety for the communities. I don't think there's any real desire on the part of the system to provide safety for the communities. It's not like this is misguided and they really believe this is safety. I mean, this is punitive racism. Like, for instance, I don't think that there's a stereotype that the families don't care. I think everybody knows the families care. On visitation day, the line goes all around the prison. I think the issue to me is, if you have contempt for the prisoner, you have contempt for the prisoner's family. So I'm worried about arguing this, Zach, in terms of a set of arguments that maybe the system wants to hear, but I don't think goes to the heart. You know, your recommendations clearly reflect a very radical critique of the existing system. And I'm just asking you if you think that it's necessary to keep making the argument that this isn't the best way to create safety.
Well, I think that we're making the argument not just towards the system, but to the broader community. And I think the reality is that there have been community-based organizations that have supported in the past some pretty reactionary policies and things that actually haven't. You had in the past some community-based organizations that supported more police on the streets, tough on crime policies, and now communities are seeing, even those folks who supported those policies are seeing some of the long-term impacts of them. And so it's not just directed towards the system, but really directed towards folks who care about racial and economic justice to say there is actually a way forward. We don't need to be engaged in punitive policies, so-called tough-on-crime policies that hurt us. And this is in our interest as a broader social justice movement to take this up. And so part of it is really looking for some allies in terms of people understanding the need for justice reinvestment to move resources away from failed tough-on-crime policies in towards the investment in community. We talk about how for many young people who have experienced trauma, what they may most need if they're, you know, struggling academically or is, if a young person has lost someone in their own life, that they may most need grief counseling. They definitely don't need to be sent to a youth prison. They definitely don't need to be involved in the justice system. But often when young people act out, they end up getting involved in the justice system. And so families talked about, look, I'm looking for help for my child. I recognize that he's not at school. These are some of the things that I think should be in place. But when they seek help, mostly what they're getting is punitive policies. And so, we make the appeal not just towards the system, but also so that people throughout the community understand this need.
Well, that's a good point. So you're arguing that at least some of the argument is to try to reassure people in the very impacted communities that are afraid of crime. We'll come back to that as a debate. Barbara, you had a point you wanted to make.
Well, I just wanted the point with regard to notifying parents when their child is ready to come home. One of the things that we found, even in the work that we're doing, is that it takes, after the child is released, they're supposed to be back in school within 48 hours. And a lot of times, they need their school records, they need inoculation shots. There's a lot of things that the parents have to prepare in order for the student to come home. So by not giving the parents enough time to do the pre-preparation, which is one of the things, too, that we talked about, that our youth need in order to get immediately back in school so that they won't be violated again.
This is pretty amazing because, I mean, obviously these are kids who started with no job, with families that have already lost a tremendous amount of money for them being in prison, come back with a bunch of crazy rules like you got to be back in school within 2 days. This whole web of racism is almost hard to document all the individual components of it. I want to move to the part of the report that I think goes to the heart of the report, page 13 in the executive summary, Stop Locking Down Youth. The reason why I think that's important is because you've done some terrific work around, you know, what are the rights of parents and radical idea that families should be involved in discussing the future of the child in court. The fact that they're not, again, is insane. So, but let's look at several examples of how do we stop the mass arrest of young black and Latino kids in the first place. So looking at your recommendations, now I want to say it quick and then I'd like your responses to be on the quick side because I want to go through them all. And we have about 7 or 8 minutes, so let's try to take a minute of each. Eliminating zero-tolerance school discipline policies. Zach, why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, kids are being sent to the, being arrested for school defiance, for talking back to teachers, for getting in schoolyard fights. These are things that should be dealt in schools, dealt with in schools by teachers and administrators. That's what happened when you and I were growing up, and that has changed over time and has disproportionately impacted black and Latino youth almost exclusively. And so this is really about stopping the school-to-prison pipeline.
Barbara, ending intrusive and discriminatory stop-and-frisk tactics by police and low-income communities of color, curbing arrests for drug possession, other low-grade misconduct in the community. Are you working on that?
Yes, we are. And that's one of the whole premises that was around the daytime curfew is stop the contact of police with our youth altogether. Just for the police to walk up and ask a kid, what's in your pocket? They reach in their pocket, they pull out any one of a marker. A marker could be a reason for the police to go further and then do a check on them, put them in handcuffs, arbitrarily place them in the database. So all of these are things that immediately criminalize our youth. So our thing is to get the police totally out of the schools.
Youth justice system should eliminate reliance on confinement and residential placement for youth by sharply reducing the number of young people confined in pretrial detention, Zach.
Yeah, I mean, 90% of resources within juvenile justice systems go toward locking up young people. So we're saying that should be flipped, and most resources should be going towards lifting up young people in programs that actually have been proven to help youth succeed, and to investments in the community that help communities thrive, rather than dumping resources towards what is proven to not be helpful.
Zach, we'll stay on you, and we'll come to Barbara next. Closing inherently abusive and dangerous youth prisons.
Yeah, families have led some amazing work to call for and succeed in closing youth prisons in California, in New York, in Louisiana. Really prophetic campaigns that have led now a national movement to close youth prisons around the country that are now recognized even among system officials as being problematic and not helpful. And so that is work that is succeeding and needs to be continued to be pushed forward.
Barbara, treating the small number of youth, it says, that system officials deem as requiring confinement, but treating them in small community-based facilities close to their homes.
Exactly. And close to home is very supportive of the families. That means that families can get to see them more often. They're in small communities that do not look like prisons. They're in small communities that has the resources that that help the youth, that go to the core of why the youth were there in the first place, that prevents them, or rather helps, or gives less incentive for them to repeat the same behavior again.
Is anything happening in that direction, Zach?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key phrase for me in that is that system officials deem as requiring confinement, because we recognize that the system as it currently is constituted is really geared towards locking up youth. And so the next recommendation is develop restorative justice models proven effective even in the most serious cases as alternatives to confinement. So we think that is the best case scenario to really investigate and deal with these problems in communities in ways that build on the strength of communities and their capacity to problem solve. But there are some approaches where youth are, in New York, they're developing a close-to-home initiative where instead of sending youth way upstate into remote rural counties, they're developing a confined setting within the city that is, you know, as Barbara talked about, preferable in the sense that at least families have access to or greater access to their loved ones, and that, you know, that can be huge and instrumental is to have community and family support be available instead of people having to drive hours to see you.
Yeah, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM and FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm with Zach Norris with Justice for Families, with Barbara Lott Holland with the Labor Community Strategy Center's Community Rights Campaign. They both worked on this new report, Families Unlocking Futures, Solutions to the Crisis in Juvenile Justice. I'm reading the executive summary, which is very cool and very accessible. We got a few more minutes. I want to make sure we talk a little bit about the report itself. The first thing is, how do people get it?
So you can go to www.justiceforfamilies.org, and it's the number 4, justice, the number 4, families.org.
And you can download both the executive summary and the full report?
Yep, right from the front page.
That's great. What's the tactical plan now? I mean, reports come out, they come out, they're good. There have been reports for 50 years. The system says, thank you very much, and I plan to do exactly what I plan to do. What's the tactical plan for this report? Start with Zach and then go to Barbara.
One of the things, and we've already had success, we had a release in D.C. yesterday, which was attended by the director of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which is kind of the foremost federal agency as it relates to juvenile justice. And we're actually optimistic and hopeful that they will take to heart some of the basic recommendations about stopping the lockout of families. It is proven across settings, and different academic researchers have shown that involving families helps young people succeed. And so we think we can move some of these objectives around stopping the lockout of families. And we think that's important because that builds people's capacity to engage in further struggle and to move some of the rest of the agenda in terms of stopping the lockdown of youth, ending some of these ridiculous fees and fines that burden low-income families and families of color. So that's kind of a foot in the door, and we think offers us more organizing opportunities to move a broader agenda.
Barbara, you're an organizer like Zach is. How would you see using this report in your own work?
Well, one of the things that we did, it was a part of our monthly meeting, the Community Rights Monthly Meeting. So all of our youth and parents got a copy of this report. The first thing it does is to connect them with other families that is experiencing the same thing that they are, to see it in print, to know that someone feels their pain and is working on it, which also helps them to stay organized as well. We've also ordered copies and have copies for the people that took the survey as well for the same thing. A lot of times our community talks and talks, but having it in print, knowing that it's being circulated, gives them the assurance that someone has heard their voice and that we are taking it to a higher level. We're also using this with our discussions with LAUSD, which is the school district here, as well as the school police, along with other documents and showing what is other alternatives. A lot of times you go to meetings and they say, yeah, but if we don't lock them up, what do we do? Well, here, we have some best practices here. We also have a survey, and that was taken from across the country. Over 10 cities was involved in this report. So those are some of the ways that we're using this.
And I would add that in reading it, just like you were saying, Barbara, I mean, I'm a big believer in the role of the written word. That I know we're in an arena of the spoken word, but there's something about reading and having your mind slow down enough to go sentence by sentence and point by point. And I think for a lot of the families who got involved, they may have a partial understanding of their own experience. But even the families involved are going to be kind of shocked, I think, mm-hmm. to see the extent, the full extent of the institutional exclusion of the families, the racism, and how the families are treated. And I also think it's trying, obviously, Zach and Barbara, it's trying to make the families into a more organized force to defend their children, because this, reading all these recommendations, it's pretty obvious that the intention of the system is to force these parents out of the process.
And I think that the most pernicious and terrible thing about it is that too many folks have internalized the blame and the shame that you talked about, Eric, and so you know, bringing folks together, having folks participate in focus groups, seeing the results, sharing the results, has really emboldened us, I think, to step forward and to, as you said, fight for the rights of young people and fight for the rights of families and communities that have been under the boot of failed justice policies for the last, you know, I don't know how many decades.
Well, I want to end by saying this to Zach and Barbara. To Zach, pretty visionary. This was your idea. You know, I know you want to say it's everybody's idea, but you can at least be one of the people who had a good idea. You used your Soros Fellowship to do this. Very visionary, in my opinion. There's a lot of great ideas. It doesn't mean they always get implemented. And the fact that you end up with this really excellent report gives you a real piece of the puzzle. Barbara, having seen you actually in the Strategy Center doing the focus groups, I think it was really good for you as well as an experience mm-hmm. in terms of your own leadership. And obviously you made a major contribution to the development of the report. So big props to you both.
Thank you.
Zach, one more time, we're going to have a new set of guests. We're going to take a break in just a second. Tell us again how we can get this report, because it's really terrific, folks. You should go get it.
Great. www.justice4families.org.
Great having you both on the show. It's really been a pleasure.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it.
Take good care, folks.